I'm joined on the line by Mark Janes, the chief announcer of the IndyCar Radio Network, as well as the Monrovia High School media and communications teacher. He's also the director of PR for the district. You got a lot on your plate, Mark. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, John. Thanks for the invitation. I'm very, very fortunate. I mean, obviously, I'm honored to be the voice of the 500 and the anchor of IndyCar Radio and the NTT IndyCar Series. But as you well know, in your capacity with Ben Davis Schools, this is a very rewarding pursuit. Our program's about 7 years old, and we have shared kids between Monrovia and Ben Davis, who I think have gone on to college and accomplished great things, and it's been a great working relationship. And it's always special when you get a chance to do it at your alma mater. And as an 82 grad of Monrovia High School, and somebody whose personal and professional success has exceeded anything that I ever imagined, it's nice to be able to come back here and give a little bit back to a place that provided me with so many wonderful memories and opportunities.
Well, that brings us to a good starting point here, because it is the month of May, and certainly you are busy this month with what goes on at the former corner of 16th and Georgetown. Now there's a roundabout there, but I'll call it 16th and Georgetown still. You're obviously very busy with what goes on there, but you're also a teacher. So how do you balance all of that out here this month of May?
Well, I mean, it goes back to when I was here the first time, and our upper level administration at the time, Dr. Paul Kaiser and Duffy Hagus, who was our principal, and Mike Springer, who was our assistant principal. And then I had the opportunity to go to Beech Grove for 5 years, where I was able to obtain my teaching license. And Paul Kaiser and Steve Cox and Randy Clevenger and Carmen Hurley were the administrators there. And I was this assistant AD, the late Matt English, and now that I've been here at Monrovia for a few years, I've been under superintendents like the late Bill Roberson and Dr. Kirk Freeman and now Trent Provo, and Mike Springer has been elevated to principal, and a name that's certainly familiar to Westsiders in the annals of high school football, Dick Burica, who is our assistant principal. I got to thank all of those folks over the years, John, because I think they understand the value of what I do and the opportunities that it gives me to provide to our students. I've had kids intern for me at the Speedway in various capacities. Got one doing it this May, in fact, for IMS Productions. And I think they like the fact that, they can use that as an advertising tool in their own right. When people are considering Monrovia High School, it's pretty cool to, from their perspective, have the voice of the 500 on board. And plus, it ties into what I do, quite frankly. I mean, it's kind of a professional development element to it, if you will. I've been blessed the last couple of years to have a former student of mine, Jonah Freeman, who's been taking online college courses, and he served as my instructional assistant last year when I had full knee replaced, but I was off for 4 weeks, and Jonah handled this just as though, if not better, than if I were here. And got to thank him too, because it puts a little more on his plate. But the way our practice schedule was split up is kind of perfect for me. We've got a couple of guys who handle the 12-3 shift, and then I have seventh period prep, and I get out of the building about 1:30, and I go up and handle the 3-6 slot. So, it works out pretty well. And then, qualifying is Saturday and Sunday when we're out of school, and I'll spend a couple of hours up there on a Monday of all the practice and qualifying weeks. And then, of course, we're out of school by the time race day rolls around. And then the majority of our races happen in the summer when I'm out of school. So I really kind of have the best of both worlds. I've always said between this at Monrovia and the NTT IndyCar Series, the Indy 500, and the IHSAA stuff I do, John, I'm lucky enough I don't do any one thing long enough to get sick of it. I get a break from everything that I do, which is nice.
Well, you probably recognize the voice. That's Mark Janes on the line here on Voices of the West Side on Indy's Giant 90.9. And Mark, what you do is certainly, you do a great job there at the 500, but
you were
very kind there in your intro to talk about the relationship that we have here with Area 31 and everything that we do with your students that you send us. So I certainly appreciate that as well, and also very much appreciate when you give us shout outs on the network. I had somebody just tell me the other day that they, you know, had heard us, heard you bring up my name. So I appreciate that very much. So as you kind of balance what you do with the teaching world and with the Motor Speedway, what you do with the IMS Radio Network and IndyCar Radio, you talked a little bit about it there and how it makes you a better teacher, but I mean, you can bring what you do straight out of the booth right into the classroom. That has to be something that gives you more credibility than maybe I would have because I'm not the chief announcer of the IMS Radio Network in IndyCar Radio.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Back when I was in Beech Grove, Dr. Kaiser talked to me a couple of times about starting a radio program there. And quite frankly, that's more in my wheelhouse than the television world is. But when I was in Beech Grove, I got to work with a guy named Wiley Kraft. And Wiley really taught me a lot about that process and the audio and video editing element to it and how to construct a show and things of that nature and how to run an operation. And Wiley left and went to Franklin Township Schools, and he was replaced by Nick White. And Nick had been an associate producer and producer at television stations in Austin, Texas, Chicago, and Indianapolis, and was a multiple Emmy Award winner. And then he left Beech Grove, and he now directs the sports communications program at Butler University. And so I was able to learn a lot about the video production element to that side. So I think, you know, story construction and things of that nature, I've leaned on some people I've gotten to know in the business over the years, like Scott Sander and Charlie Clifford. Now we have Rich Nye on board. And, you know, I've brought a lot of those people in to work with our kids and not only teach them, but teach me about the video production element of it, with my background being primarily in radio. But, yeah, just, you know, the interviewing skills, I think, and how to interview and how to research and how to prepare. The play-by-play element, we're an IHSAA Champions Network affiliate, and it's been a lot of fun to live stream our boys and girls basketball game. We did one on the road for the first time this year when our girls made the regional in Greencastle. So, you know, other areas in which I can expose our kids to the business is that you know, Jason Willie and Heath Shanahan and Brian Lewis and Chris Coffin and all those wonderful folks headed up by Paul Nighting, you know, I'm leaving a few out, but they're cooperative, but just as the others that I named. I typically, when I do a state championship, be it volleyball or wrestling or football or basketball, they allow me to get a credential for one or two of my students, and they're able to go behind the scenes and see how the television production works and how the on-air aspect of it works and everything. So, that's kind of how I drag my other duties into this world. And I think it's allowed some of our students to kind of develop a pretty solid network that gives them a good start on their collegiate career. You know, over the past 4 or 5 years, we've had a tremendous amount of success. A young man that was in my very first class here, Andrew Willett, is Ball State grad, and he is now a replay producer at ESPN in Charlotte. Another one of our students is doing commercial film production in Nashville. We've got, you know, one at IU and one at Grace College. We still have 5 at Ball State. We have one headed Indiana State this fall. So, you know, as you well know, John, I share with them the passion and enthusiasm and how much fun the job is. I just don't tell them what it pays. I let them figure that out down the road.
Yeah, they'll figure that part out later. But, you know, like you said earlier, too, you don't have to worry about, you know, wanting to get up and go to work. You just do it. And that's the fun part of this job, is that we want to be there and you want to get in and be in there with the students and cover all the events that you cover. And then, you know, at the end of the day, you're tired, but hey, it's a lot of fun what we do. Yep. So you talked a little bit about your background, a 1982 graduate of Monrovia High School. How do you get to be the chief announcer of the greatest spectacle in racing?
Align yourself with the right people. It's like that network building I talk about with our kids. The big break came, you know, when I was first introduced to WTHI radio in Terre Haute. I went to work there while I was a student at Indiana State, and then I eventually left there after I got married and started a family, wanted to move back to central Indiana to have my kids close to their grandparents. And you know, I spent 4 years in Martinsville as the news and sports director, and then went back to Terre Haute in 1994. And that was kind of what got it started. And, you know, I our boss at WTHI was also the entertainment director at the state fair. And the guy that was in charge of the sound at the grandstand was a guy named John Royer. And John was our longtime affiliate relations director. And John took a liking to me and stopped me in 1995. And when we were doing the Indy Mile, the old AMA race at the fairgrounds, and he said, "Hey, we're the Indy Racing League starting next year, and we need people that's going to be able to travel and do all the races." And he said, "Since you already work for the family, because THI, as I said, owned by the Hall of George family," he said, "you might let me get you connected to Bob Jenkins." And of course, there weren't cell phones or emails at that time, so I put an air check together and set him a resume off. And December of 95, they announced a broadcast crew for the first race at Disney, and I was not a part of it. And then I didn't hear anything for the second race at Phoenix. But then I was at the Terre Haute Chamber of Commerce dinner, and Mike King, who had joined the network the year before, was the sports director on the television side of WTHI, told me that Bob was asking me questions, asking him questions about me, rather. And so just prior to the start of the first weekend of qualifying, there were two weekends at that time, Bob called me, and I went up and met with him, and I didn't hear anything. And then I was walking through the garage because I was up there covering qualifying for WTHI, and Chris Duffy, who was the president of Wabash Valley Broadcasting at the time, the parent company, asked me how my first day with the network went. And I said, "Well, Chris, I haven't been hired yet." And so he was a little embarrassed by that because he broke the news to me. And the following Monday, Bob Jenkins called me and said, "Well, Mark, I'm sorry you had to find out this way, but welcome aboard the IMS radio network." And so I started the second weekend of qualifying. They threw me in the deep end because my very first interview was with Danny Ungaius after he had been named to replace Scott Brayton, who had been killed in a crash. And I remember walking up to him and saying, "I know this doesn't mean anything to you," I said, "but this is my very first assignment. This is something that I've wanted to do for a long time. And I think, you know, that I understand that people want to hear from you." And he said, "Okay." He said, "Don't mention Scott's name. Don't ask me what I think. Don't ask me how I feel about what happened." He said, "You can ask me about the car or whatever we're going to do. The plan is for today." He said, "If you mention his name, I'm walking away." And so I think I did a good job. He was happy with it. Bob was surprised later that I was able to get the interview. And, you know, I remember going home, John, after my first Indy 500, and I didn't sleep the night before. I was sitting on the porch all night long. And and my wife, when I got home, she said, "How do you think it went?" And I said, "Well, I think it went well. But I said, if I never do it again, I'll have done it one more time that a lot of people, you know, get to. And so I'll be happy with that." And a week later, they called me, asked me to go to New Hampshire. And then in January of 97, I joined the crew full time and started traveling with them. And I was in the pits 97, 98, 99. Then in 2000, thanks to Mike King, I was elevated to turn three. And I was there for 15 years. And, you know, when Mike stepped away from the network, Paul Page came back for 2 years. And did so with the understanding that, you know, he would eventually hand the baton off to his successor. And, you know, I went in and pled my case with Wally Levin, who was our network director, and Robbie Green, who was the president of IMS Productions. And I'll never forget when I was at a swim meet as assistant athletic director at Beach Grove on a Saturday afternoon, Wally came and told me that I was the new voice of the 500. And it was a pretty emotional moment for sure. And I took the baton from Paul during the 100th, and lo and behold, it's my 30th year with the network and be my 10th as the voice of the 500.
That's Mark James joining us here on Voices of the West Side on Indy's Giant 90.9. And, you know, you talk about that, and you mentioned Bob Jenkins' name, and you may not know this, but, you know, I never met Bob personally. I exchanged emails with him, and before he unfortunately was diagnosed with cancer, we had made informal arrangements for him to come out and speak to our kids, and, yeah. You know, he never unfortunately got to do that. But Bob, I still remember the email he said, and I can hear, you know, sometimes you can hear someone's voice,
sure,
as they send you an email. And I remember him, and he's like, "John, I no longer do these, but for you, I'll make an exception. You know, it's just like, okay, that's Bob. I've got my Bob Jenkins email now. And, you know, just a tremendous impact on me, because one of the reasons why I wanted to do radio is the IMS Radio Network. Growing up, I would listen to the 500 as a kid. I can still remember, I think the first race I listened to was the 1982 race in the dramatic finish there with Gordon Johncock and Rick Mears, and hearing Paul Page do that. And then came of age when Lou Palmer and Bob Jenkins were the voices of the 500. And, you know, those voices made me want to do play-by-play. Because I don't believe there's a better example of radio play-by-play than what you guys do on race day. It is tremendous, and it's a story that is told. And, you know, I think a couple of years ago, they Peyton Manning did a whole series where you've seen the Indy 500, but you haven't seen this Indy 500 or something, right, something like that. And that describes the Indianapolis 500, because there have been 108 of them, and they've all been different. Sometimes similar things happen, but there's always something different about every 500. So as a storyteller, what kinds of things do you do to prepare yourself to tell the story of the 109th Indianapolis 500?
Well, I mean, we have our usual statistical supplements, and Scott Richards, who was very close to Bob, matter of fact, he helped care for Bob in the final few months of his life, and I got to know Scott through Bob, and I mean, the guy is a stat wizard, and he typically sends a few of us a packet that he starts preparing in January, and it's got literally every little tidbit of information that you could hope to have. And, you know, once upon a time, John, the broadcast is such to where a lot of that stuff would have to be used, but because of the fact it moves so fast now, we just kind of have to let things happen organically. I mean, I've never gone into a broadcast with a preconceived notion as to exactly what the focus is going to be on, because we never know how the race is going to play out. I mean, I've had a couple of people ask me, you know, because Sid was known to have pieces of prose at the ready for various scenarios that unfolded. And I never subscribed to that theory. That's what worked well for Sid, and I respect that. But I've never done things that way. I mean, I will have a scripted open for sure, which I start working on in late March or early April. But as far as the race itself, we kind of let it happen organically. And when Elio won his fourth, people have asked me a couple of times as he's crossing the finish line, when I came up with the line, and then there were four, they said, did you have that written down somewhere? And I said, no, as a matter of fact, I didn't. And I said, don't ask me why, but that line came to me when he was coming out of turn four. I didn't have any preconceived notion of using that, because, I mean, I was hopeful that I would get the chance to be a part of all four of his 500 wins, if that were to happen. I you know, the stories kind of unfold. The thing that we have fallen upon in discussion groups amongst us as a network staff over the past couple of years, okay, who is the and you'll pardon the bells going off here at school,
that's but, okay, happened here too.
But I said that what we all kind of get together and have a discussion, okay, who is the name driver that's going to struggle to make the Indy 500? And you know it's going to be somebody, because there's 33 cars and you know, 34 spots. And that's the thing we look at every year. And the place is not picky about who it does and doesn't pick. I mean, you know, you've had accomplished racers like Graham Rahal and Marcus Ericsson and Will Power struggled mightily to make the race. Fernando Alonso, the Formula One champion, been knocked out of the Indy 500. And so those are the kind of things that we look for to happen organically. And I guess the advantage that we have, like me, Nick Yeoman, Michael Young, Jake Query, Alex Wolf, the advantage that we have, John, over our predecessors is, it's amazing to think that those guys and gals came in and did that one time a year. And we get the advantage of having done it, you know, 15, 16, 17 times a year. So we know the drivers, and We know the teams, and we know a lot of those stories and have a background on a lot of those teams and drivers. And so those are the ways that, you know, we're able to employ. You know, I mean, once upon a time, I'll never forget, I forget which race I was listening to, but Johnny Ruthenberg's going through turn two, and Howdy Bell makes the comment, "I know Johnny Ruthenberg, Johnny's a friend of mine. He's going to be a happy guy, and I know Johnny Ruthenberg likes homemade strawberry ice cream." Well, we don't have time to tell those stories now because they're moving at 230 miles an hour instead of 150 like they were in those days. So it's a different broadcast for sure. It's a higher tempo, and I think we reserve our practice and some of our qualifying shows at Carb Day to tell those stories. But when it comes to the race, we're kind of locked in on play-by-play and describing exactly what's happened, and we kind of confine what we do to that.
One question I've always had, and I kind of know a little bit about how it used to be structured because you used to be able to see the old equipment there in the old museum. There was a display in there, and every time I would go in there, I'd marvel at that old switcher that they would have in there. But it starts, a lap starts coming out of four with Chris Denary. Then it goes to you, then Michael Young, then Nick Yeoman, then Michael Young, then Jake Query, and then back to Chris Denary. How does that work in concert with each other? Is it instinct, or is it like, okay, Jake, you have from this moment until this moment, then you have to hand off to Chris. Chris, you have this moment, then you hand off to me.
Yeah, excuse me. Instinct and trust and familiarity all play a part in that. I mean, we have some built-in drop points. Like, for instance, Chris knows to drop them to me right at the entrance to the pit lane. And then because of the fact we moved from the ninth floor a few years ago to the fourth floor of the media center, I can't see all the way down into turn one. And so I'll drop them to Nick at basically the scoring pylon. And then usually there's a logo that Nick will drop them usually at the logo in the south short chute. There's a wing of the wheels on the outside wall, and that's where he drops them to Michael. And then Michael probably has more flexibility with Jake than anybody because he can drop them anywhere around the halfway point. Jake's going to pick them up. And then Jake ideally drops them to Chris at the wing of the wheels at the short chute in the north end. The one thing that we have done over the last few years since I took over as the anchor, though, and then again, this is where the trust factor comes in. You know, it's one of the things that Paul kind of marveled at, you know, when he first heard me do it. If Jake is in the middle of a call in turn three and Rob Blackman is on the pit lane and the leader is pulling in, I can hit the intercom button and tell Jake Query to throw it straight to Rob without sending it back through me to the booth. And I don't, you know, Paul and I had a discussion about that, and he felt like all the traffic needed to come through the booth. But I said, if we're allowed to get there quicker and tell the story, that's the immediacy that radio has over television. And so that's how we do things. And by the same token, the pit guys know that if they need to throw it out to a turn, they're all prepared to do that. I will say that we're all on one channel when we go to Detroit or Long Beach or Iowa or Gateway. But at the Indianapolis 500, I'm thankful for the fact that my intercom system, my off-air system, is connected only to the turns. And I have a toggle switch next to me, and I'm able to flip over and communicate with the pits and hear what the pits are saying and doing. But I also have a pit producer, Brian Livingston, who has over 40 years at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway with our network. And our pit reporters, by and large, talk to Brian, and Brian kind of directs traffic for me in terms of who to throw it to and when. And that makes the task a lot less daunting, for sure. But to get back to the original question in terms of how seamless we seem to be, everybody has their theories that we can press the button and turn a light on. We're all talking all the time, and they just turn us off and on. But it is just, it too happens organically, and I don't want to wear that phrase out. And there's just a level of trust that we all have with one another and each other's cadence that we're used to. And that's what seems to make it work so well.
Well, I know, as well that your calls stand the test of time, certainly as well. Is there any more pressure that you feel because you know if something big happens that is going to be played on a highlight maybe 50 years from now?
Well, you know, it's interesting you should say that because, you know, we you go back to the issue between Elio Castro Neves and Paul Tracy, that memorable year, which Elio was given the 500 and Paul still thinks he won it. You know, there was a little uncertainty in our broadcast in terms of what the ruling was. And, our good friend, Kurt Gavin, Kurt wrote an editorial, wrote a column on it and said, even the experts at IndyCar Radio weren't sure what the ruling was. If and I'm paraphrasing, it was something along those lines. And so, you know, that kind of drew the iron, understandably so, of Mike King, who was our anchor, and he and Kurt had a spirited back and forth on it. Well, I ran into Kurt later that year at the racetrack. I think it was at Richmond. He goes, "You mad at me too?" And I said, "No, no." I said, "You and I have been friends too long for that." I said, "But I said, I do want to make this point to you. I said, I want you to sit down tonight and I want you to write the story on this race. And I said, I don't want you to use autocorrect. I don't want you to hit backspace. And you tell your editor to submit exactly what you turn in the way you turn it in." And he looked at me and I said, "When you do that, then you've walked in our shoes, because we don't get backspace. We don't get to erase. We don't get an edit, and we don't get a do-over. We get to do it one time and one time only." And I remember telling that story to Bob Jenkins one time, and Bob said, "You know, Mark, I wished I would have thought of that a long time ago, because I could have won a lot of arguments about people who were critical of us and what we do." I will go back and listen to some finishes and think, yeah, I probably could have been a little bit smoother there. But I don't think in terms of the pressure, in terms of the audience. I will say the late John Royer told me one time, he said, you want to make sure that you, when you call the finish, he said, you either need to say the 109th Indy 500 or the 2025 Indy 500. He said, because that will be the one that they put in the videos, because you're identifying which race it is. And that's the one that'll live on for a long, long time. And I've heard a few of my calls in some videos and promos and things of that nature, which is pretty cool. So there's a thought process behind it, but I don't know that I necessarily have felt any pressure to get that call right. I'm just lucky that so far I've been able to do that.
Well, I was thinking back, because it was just posted. I think Nick Gilman posted it the other day, the call from the 2011 Indy 500, where J.R. Hildebrand hit the wall coming out of four, and there was some question of who has won, and Mike King held off until he, I think it was Paul Page actually in the booth with him, that said Dan Weldon, and that's when they got it.
Paul was a little more focused on Dan Weldon because his son was working for Dan as an engineer at the time. So Paul had a vested interest in where Dan Weldon was. But yeah, it was a confusing time, and that's one that certainly will. I told Chris Denary, I said, you know, Chris, stopping short of you getting the opportunity to call a buzzer beating shot for the Indiana Pacers to win a championship, I said, that call on the IMS radio network where he says he hits the wall will probably be the one that the one call of Chris's that will live on for decades to come, for sure. Mike told me, John, you talk about pressure, and I'll explain it this way. Mike had warned me up front, and I didn't really understand what he was talking about until it was over. Mike told me, he said, when you sign off and you turn the mic off and you take the headphones off and you push back from the counter, he said, your hands are going to be shaking to the point where you can't stop them. And he was spot on about that, because your mind is moving so fast for so long, for the better part of 4.5 hours, and it's just not possible for you to shut that off. And that's what you're asked to do. And, you know, for a handful of years, I lived at the corner 25th and McRae, and I would walk back and forth. And I remember my first year as the anchor, I walked home and neighbors came out, were congratulating me and say how much they enjoyed it. And I had a lot of family there. And I went in and walked down to the basement and I sat down with a glass of iced tea, and my wife came down. She said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, not really." I said, "I love him to death, but I'd really not rather not have all these people here." I said, "I don't want to do this again next year." And so, the next year it was just me and her, and I was able to kind of unwind and watch the tape delayed broadcast and the Coca-Cola 600. And, you know, quite frankly, it's about 24 to 36 hours before I feel like that I'm kind of back to normal because of how daunting that task is. Don't get me wrong, I love it, but I'm thankful that that's one day a year because it takes a while to recover from it for sure.
Well, and I think I heard Bob Jenkins in an interview talk about that same thing, about how just completely draining that broadcast is, and I think that was one of the reasons why he ultimately made the decision to go to TV, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah, there's no question about that. He said radio was 10 times harder than television. And, you know, the television that I've dabbled in with the IHSAA Champions Network, I get that because I'm not only anchoring the show, but I'm essentially producing and directing the show as well. I mean, what we do and how we do it and when we go to who is all on me. And, you know, I have some direction in terms of when to take a break and things of that nature. But, you know, there's the pressure right off the bat of timing into all the trackside elements that I added back in when I took over as anchor, you know, the taps and things of that nature. And we've got to time into that by the second and, you know, and get all the way up to back home again in Indiana, the green flag. And, you know, it's kind of a roller coaster of adrenaline, John, because, you know, the first 25, 30 laps or so is pretty high energy. And then we settle into the middle third of the race and things calm down a little bit. And it becomes very much like a broadcast that we would do at any other racetrack during the year. But then again, you go back to the last 50 laps and your adrenaline starts pumping again. And then, as you suggest, the pressure to get that the call to that finish right starts to seep into your consciousness a little bit. And then, from an adrenaline standpoint, you know, you get a shot here and then it drops down and then you take another shot. And I won't say it's physically exhausting, but it's certainly mentally and emotionally challenging.
Well, you've been listening to Mark James, who's been kind enough to join us and give us a half an hour or so of his time here in a very busy month of May. And Mark, how many people listen to the broadcast on May 25th coming up?
Well, John, it's in the millions easily, and as you know, the changing face of live stream and broadcasting and satellite radio is kind of made that measurement a bit more difficult in terms of hammering it down exactly. I mean, you know, we're around 300-plus affiliates nowadays, but we're also on Sirius XM. We're on the TuneIn app. We're on the Mixlr app. We're on IndyCar.com, IndyCarRadio.com. So, you know, there's a lot of different ways in which people can enjoy the 500, and some of those services don't make numbers available to us, but we do know the audience is likely as massive as it ever was, and we're honored and privileged to have the responsibility to, as I put it, make people who aren't there feel as though they are and enhance the experience of those that happen to be there listening to us.
Well, I always say no disrespect to the people at Fox, but radio has better pictures when it comes to the 500 because you guys do a tremendous job. And, you know, I think back to your Elio call. I'm up in my living room just yelling and screaming, go Elio, go, you know, because he's my guy. So everybody's got their favorite driver. I'm hoping Elio gets his fifth this year, and I'll be anxious to see what you say if he crosses the line first and gets the twin checkers.
There's a lot of historic storylines, the potential, you know, the three-peat by Joseph Newgarden. You've got Takuma Sato that could join the three-time winners club. And, of course, Elio, an unprecedented fifth win. But ultimately, I think no matter who wins, it's a big story because it's the greatest spectacle in racing. And first-time winners are always exciting. Repeat winners are equally as thrilling, and I'll give you a little sneak peek as to our pre-race show. It'll be a feature on just that, John. We ask drivers who have won it what's stronger, the desire to win it or the desire to win it again, which provided some fascinating answers. And then we ask more than a handful of drivers as to how often they think about winning the Indy 500. And I'll tease and say Pato O'Ward gave perhaps his answer was very, very brief, but is perhaps the most powerful. So we hope folks will enjoy that as the manner in which I chose to welcome people to our broadcast on race day.
Well, Mark, certainly we'll be looking forward to that broadcast, and I have to say thank you for what you do at Monrovia as well, and keep sending your kids up here to the Area 31 Career Center, you know, for my future employment. But no, just keeping the kids and the pipeline open from there, because we really appreciate what you do at Monrovia, and I so appreciate IndyCar Radio and all you do there as well.
Well, you're a fan, but more importantly, you're a friend, and we're happy to be a part of your family. My son's getting ready to start his third year on the defensive staff at Ben Davis, and you guys, everyone from, you know, throughout the athletic department, the administration, and certainly the football staff, Coach Mann, gave him an opportunity to be a part of the state championship winning team. And it was a special moment for me because I got to call that game on the IHSAA Champions Network. And he's got an opportunity to be heavily invested in one of the iconic high school football programs, not only in the state of Indiana, but in the Midwest. And everybody has been very welcoming to our family at Ben Davis, and we appreciate it. And while we're certainly excited about the racing season to come, we know that it's less than 100 days now till high school football returns, and we'll all be back together again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Mark, for joining us here on Voices of the West Side.
All right, John. Glad to do it. Take care. Happy race day.